to the Axis of Easy Salon. This is the first one of 2021. We've had a bit of a break. I've got Charles Hugh Smith with us from Hawaii, Jesse Hirsch in Toronto. We are doing things a little differently today because we've hit some technical difficulties and we are rolling with the punches and trying a different setup, courtesy of Jesse. So this is the first episode, January 14th, 2021. Hope everybody had a great holiday, a happy new year so far, as best as can be expected. And what do you guys want to talk about today?
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Okay. I've been having conversations with friends about lack of civic obligation here in the U.S. about following the rules to do what we can behaviorally to limit COVID-19. And I'm wondering if that's not a long-term trend, you know, the loss of civic duty, civic obligation, civic responsibility, to where the what matters now is what I believe and what I want to do. My personal freedom is more important than my obligation to the community. And I wonder about that.
Right on. I mean, I agree. I think I've been having similar thoughts in terms of the moral responsibilities we have in a time of crisis. And ironically, I've been thinking about it not just in the context of the pandemic, but in the sort of larger context of the pandemic effects, whether that's the mental health impacts of people being isolated, whether that's the anxiety in terms of our economic future, or whether that's just, from my perspective, the kind of learning that comes with technology and the idea that we want to sort of spread literacy as far and wide as possible. And so I welcome that, Charles. I welcome the ways in which we can think about the means in which we can foster greater cooperation and foster greater dialogue and foster greater moral commitment that, like, we're, you know, our brother's keeper, that we're responsible for each other in a broader community sense. So I think, given that this is our first chat in the new year, I think that's a very appropriate topic. And I think it helps frame the kind of news and current affairs that's currently going on in our world.
I'm torn which direction to approach this topic from, because I know that my thoughts around things like lockdowns are a little different from yours. If I go to the other end of the spectrum, so where Charles is talking about civic cooperation or civic duty, I look at governance failures as well, because out of the policymakers and the governance structures, we're seeing a sort of one-size-fits-all approach to this. Contrast to some other parts of the world, like, you're hearing no other mitigation strategies coming out of the government here in Ontario or in Canada generally, and I don't know about the states, about things like nutrition, sunlight, vitamin D, zinc, those sorts of things. Whereas in countries like India, they're distributing kits to the citizens that contain these things, and they're very low cost, and it's like they're employing it as an additional mitigation strategy. Whereas here, it's lockdowns, 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 and if the lockdowns aren't working, which they aren't here in Canada, then let's just lock down harder. And I just find that it's hard to cultivate this sense of civic duty when you're being bombarded with governance failure from above. And I mean, I got really triggered over the holidays when just the list of government officials who were jumping on planes and flying to the Caribbean and flying to Hawaii while they were telling everybody else to cancel Christmas and stay home. I mean, that was infuriating. I like completely lost it from that. It doesn't surprise me that there's this lack of civic unity. And there's also the politicization of it all, which I've decried it all, decried as well. But, and then I'm also wondering, is it really, is it happening to the same extent here in Ontario as Charles is commenting on it in the States? Because I find here, mask is near universal. Like, I don't really see, I mean, there's people, there's anti-maskers and stuff, but they're pretty small. So you have mask compliance is almost 100%. Lockdown compliance, people are grumbling, but I think, I won't say 100% compliance. There's obviously edge cases and stuff. So, but for the most part, I think people are going along with these directives. I'm just questioning why it's a, you know, one-way policy or sort of a single policy approach when this policy seems to be not working. Yeah.
Jesse, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think Mark raises a legitimate point in that when the governance as a whole is failing, it's difficult. One of the signs of that dysfunction is it's difficult to get people to comply. And I think Mark's request for a diversity of policy, a policy debate, so that at the very least you can compare and contrast the lockdown strategy with maybe other strategies, because not that I'm in favor of it, but, you know, Singapore and some Asian countries are using very heavy surveillance measures as part of their contact tracing. Now, Singapore is different partly because it's a city state and not a nation. But, you know, China similarly has been very successful. Taiwan has been very successful at combating the virus using very aggressive surveillance measures and very aggressive contact tracing measures, so they can literally sort of map out where the virus is and where transmission is. I'm not sure that such an approach is politically viable here in North America, but I think it's why a comparative policy debate would be so helpful. Because I think when you start looking at the different measures that are available, as well as brainstorming and imagining measures that have not yet been implemented, because I think that's another fair part of a policy process, I think at the very least, the consequence of such a debate is it fosters literacy. It helps people understand things like the majority of the transmission of this virus is asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic, meaning that there's literally no way to detect it. Right. And in fostering that type of literacy and connecting people to the kind of research that's going on, I think that not only makes a more informed policy process, but I think it inadvertently gets buy-in. It gets people to really understand the nature of the threat we're dealing with and to open up in terms of the possibilities that are there. Because I also obviously feel that the Ontario provincial government, where Mark and I live, has been completely mishandling this, and they're basically clowns. But so too are most governments, right? Like, there's very few good examples you can point to of, oh, they're being responsive. Oh, they're being smart. Oh, they're really handling this. And that's where I do share Charles's fear that the United States, and I read an interesting essay on it this week, which unfortunately I cannot recall who wrote it or even what the title was. But it was the idea, it was looking at what's happened in Ireland, in that Ireland had largely defeated the virus. Their transmission rates were so low. But then they had this ludicrous spike because they were also privy to the UK variant of the current coronavirus, which is way more infectious. And the spread in Ireland was ridiculous and so fast and catastrophic. And there's a lot of people saying that that's about to happen in the United States. That the United States, in fact, could be subject to two of those extreme spikes because of the nature of the geography in the U.S. and the sort of travel patterns. But nonetheless, there's a lot of tea leaves out there saying that as terrible as it's been in the United States, we're about to see it get a whole lot worse.
Yeah, and that's I was going to send you guys a link to a survey of articles on that topic by Eve Smith at I think it's her site, Naked Capitalism, something like that. Yeah, it is extremely sobering, and kind of that's part of why I was interested in talking about what is what has eroded in the U.S. in particular, and I would suspect it's different in Canada because of the cultural differences, and it there's of course variations in Europe and Asia as well, as we're talking about, is that in Asia there's still, as a generality, now I can only speak directly to Japan and Thailand, where I visited and have friends, but I think Korea I've visited, it would be a good subject, and Vietnam too has been very successful. But I think there's a really high level of social obligation and social responsibility. And it's not just, I think in the US, we have this sort of, blinders view that, well, that's because they're obedient and passive, and they just do what the government says. And it's all like, well, that's not quite all that's all that's going on here. Yes, they do tend to be more obedient to the government. The government is much more, in a lot of these countries, is much more ready to take decisive action against citizens who don't follow the rules. Singapore being a good example of a democracy that has zero tolerance for idiots that, endanger the entire community. So I think there's something else going on. It's not just obedience to authority. It's all like, well, this is my duty. This is my responsibility. This is part of the social contract, And in the U.S., in thinking about it, it seems to me the social contract, like so many things, has become one-sided. The government or somebody is supposed to take care of me and give me free money and free opportunities and this and that. But what's the obligation of the citizen to his or her community? And it's all like, well, none. And it's all like, well, maybe that's why we're going to hell in a handbasket with COVID, is that there's no sense of personal responsibility to the community anymore. Never mind authority. It's like, you can figure it out yourself. You don't need somebody telling you. And I think I noticed that in Hawaii, being, I think, perhaps an island state and more of a tolerant society, because there's a lot of ethnic mix here. There is no majority ethnicity here. But people are really, and the public health message is, you are responsible to, whether you like it or not, you're responsible to wear a mask to protect others. Never mind what you want to do or what you believe, it's your responsibility. And the Hawaiian word for responsibility in this sort of broad sense is kuleana. So this is the promotion or the PR, and it seems to be working. People feel that they owe it, never mind if they like it or not. And that's something that I don't see anywhere else in the U.S. at all. And that troubles me.
I think what feeds that, what makes it so much worse, and I don't see it being terribly different in Canada, maybe a milder form of it, is how it all became politicized. And that's what really, it exhausts me, really, that it was just absolutely political. Well, not from the word go, but as it started to play out, and it almost demarcated along party lines. Like, you don't hear a lot about, I don't even want to say one name or the other, but it just seemed like, here's something that's an intractable problem. No matter how you slice it, there are no easy answers. If I can quote Munger at this point, Charlie Munger, it's like, this isn't easy, and anybody who thinks it's easy is stupid, right? This is the situation we're in. And so we have this situation that's hard enough as it is. And then you have to project political imperatives over top of it, so that if you believe this and you don't believe this, it means that you think like this and not like this, and it's almost mind-numbing. And I was gonna say that, Charles, there's no sense of civic duty, because because personal responsibility isn't a thing anymore. And, I lean libertarian, and we're all about personal responsibility. And I think where people sort of take libertarianism to its cartoonish extreme is that, well, libertarians want to live alone on an island, man against, you know, war against all, and you don't need anybody else for anything. And that's not really it at all. I mean, libertarianism, as I understand it, is we all take responsibility for our own actions, and we can't really get big things done without cooperating with each other. And we're only going to cooperate with each other if we all, you know, all parties involved are getting mutual benefit and mutual value from whatever is happening. And so a civic responsibility kind of endeavor, like dealing with a pandemic, you're not really going to see the benefits firsthand. Right. If I wear a mask now and it stops, you know, I go to a long-term care home and no one's going to get it. Well, I don't, it's almost like, sorry, I'm kind of drifting, but it's almost like the business I'm in as my day job in the DNS business. As long as you're doing everything right, nobody notices you exist. And you only get noticed when things go wrong. It's kind of like that in a pandemic. If you're doing things right, nothing really comes of it. If you're doing things wrong, then the situation just gets worse and worse. And so it's harder, again, to get people to retain that sense of civic responsibility, because I think we've really quashed that sense of personal responsibility over not 2020, not 2019, but over generations. It's just kind of been iterated out. I mean, I've been rereading The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe, and it is kind of playing along there. I mean, it's not a predictive or a prophetic thing as much as it's a framework for looking at how cycles affect the trajectory of events. And I think they did do a fairly good job of describing what a fourth turn looks like, and we're in one. And yeah, that's just kind of the nature of this, the generational seasonality we're in, is that there's this diminishment in personal responsibility and this diminishment in civic duty. But I think we're going to see it start to reverse, maybe, I hope. I don't know. It's going to be a rough few years, though. I was coming into this thinking this should all be largely in the rearview mirror over the course of 2021, and now I'm just thinking, welcome to the jackpot. This is just going to, this is the next 6 to 10 years. Not the pandemic per se, but just this rolling set of systemic crises that just keep magnifying this lack of civic cohesion and personal responsibility.
I mean, with all due respect, I think part of your frustration with the pandemic is the extent to which you may have misread it at the beginning and are only now starting to see both the clusterfuck that it is and the long-term process that it is, and how it's intrinsically tied to, for lack of a better word, the kleptocratic culture that permeates society. Because I disagree entirely with your original assertion that the pandemic should not be political. It's the most political event in our lifetime. Maybe, you know, I was going to say in our parents' lifetime, because in my case, my parents were born after the Second World War. So I can say that, yes, it's the most significant political event in their lifetime. But I think what you're conflating is partisanship, right? What you're conflating is polarization. And that predates the pandemic, right? Politics in the United States, politics in Canada was broken and dysfunctional before the pandemic happened. And that's part of what's made the pandemic such a complete mess. Because the institutions and the governments that should have been there to mitigate the effects of it were incompetent. Right. They were not prepared. They were not in a position to actually sort of help the population and guide the population through what is. And actually, let me revise that. It's not a political crisis. It's a political economic crisis, because you can't separate the two. You can't separate power and money. And power and money from 2008 was already in this kind of bifurcation in which the rich were getting richer and the poor were getting poorer at such a radical rate. And the pandemic only exacerbates that even more. So for sure it's political. For sure there should be debates. But I share your frustration that there is no debate going on. that there is no discussion going on, that there's name calling, that there's, you know, different sides sort of, you know, accusing each other of being on the other side, but not actually having a conversation on how we should be addressing this. And that's where I think your other point, which I will rearticulate, that the culture of narcissism is the real liability that our society faces. And we've been nurturing narcissism for, you know, the last several decades at the very least. And it's this idea that life is about you, that, you know, your pursuit in life can be all about your own interests, your own pleasure, without recognizing that individuals only exist because of the security that communities provide. And there needs to be a balance. Just as there's a balance between rights and responsibilities, there needs to be a balance between your individual liberty and your social responsibility. And the culture of narcissism has eroded that. The culture of narcissism has created this world in which attention is the end, justified by any means. So, you know, who cares if it's a pandemic? Go out and do a photo shoot. You know, go out and have a party. Go out and, you know, have some influencer event with your other friends who are social media. Like, and I only say that because in the last week, there's been a bit of a backlash against, in particular, some TikTok influencers who spent the holidays all partying with each other. You know, to your point, Mark, the same way about politicians who tell us to stay home and then go on vacation in a private jet to some, you know, Caribbean destination. So I think
don't
that's...
Don't get me started.
Right, but that's the point, right? Is that the narcissism of our culture undermines the message that we're all in this together. And we are all in this together because the virus doesn't care about our narcissism, right? The virus doesn't care, you know, whether we wear a mask or not. It's gonna infect us. The mask helps limit the virus, but it's not a magic wand. I mean, we need more than just mask wearing. We need people to be smart about how they relate to this pandemic. And when our leaders are dumb, well, it sure makes it difficult for people to be smart.
Yeah, all good points. I'm going to pick up on your culture of narcissism, which I think is so true. And I'm interested in where did it come from? Or in other words, how come it's gathered velocity or something in the last 20 years? And I think there was a book in the 80s that was called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism or something like that. And the point of the book was, hey, look, as consumers, we're encouraged and incentivized to be narcissistic, right? Because that's how we are exploited as consumers, right? Like we're told you're not hip enough or cool enough here unless you buy this. And of course that will change in a month or two. And then you have to buy more stuff, right? To stay, you know, legitimate. And so it becomes consumerism itself it drives narcissism, right? And the contradiction is that capitalism in whatever form it is requires cooperation too, right? You actually have to produce stuff for everybody to consume. And so that's a cooperative venture. So you can't have it both ways. And I'm really interested in what you both have to say about my second point here of cultural narcissism is social media. And it used to be, you know, back in two generations ago, if you wanted to see your name in print or something, you could write a letter to the editor of the local paper, or you could be really lucky and be standing in front of the house fire that the local news crew is visiting. And then you might be in the background there, you know, and you could wave to your friends or whatever. And so now it's all like, you know, what I call the billion channels of me. Are out there. And so that's how could it not exacerbate the culture of narcissism? But I'm interested, maybe I'm missing something there. So I want to hear what you guys think of that.
Jesse? I mean, I was listening to you saying that and thinking, yeah, I know exactly where this all comes from. It comes from the mainstream media. And then you got onto the social media thing. I said, no, it doesn't come from the mainstream media. It comes from social media. Like it was just jumping, like almost hopscotching from, yeah, this is the problem. No, this is the problem. I completely lost my train of thought.
I'll bail you out quickly by saying, you know, Marshall McLuhan, one of the people I love to cite on this podcast regularly, you know, he talked about this going right back to radio, right? That he would argue all of this began with electronic media, that the printed page, which the two of you are so fond of, right? I mean, this is the irony. You could call this podcast two audiophiles and an internet guy, even though Mark is also an internet guy, but still, right? And that the book, the printed page, created the individual. That before the printed page, there was the spoken word. And there were no individuals in tribal societies. In oral societies, there was no way to distinguish your thoughts, to distinguish your ideas from the group. But if you could put your ideas on a printed page, well, then you were different. And the act of reading differentiated you from what was on the page. So the printed page is where individuals came from. And as soon as our media became electronic, as soon as our media became digital, it's not that the individual went away. On the contrary, that's the point of narcissism. But electronic media and digital media once again changed our relationship. And if you want to be really ludicrous, you could say that the individual from the printed page had their head stuck up their ass with the digital media, and that creates the narcissistic feedback loop in which you no longer have the critical individual. Instead, you have the obsessive individual, and that's the kind of individual we have today. Again, a bit of a tangent, and I'll bring it back to you, Mark, but a way of saying, I think what we're describing are media effects. And these media effects are really what are doing the polarization, fueling the narcissism, and different media have different effects, but I think we're seeing trends that go all the way back to the days of radio.
This, what you said made me think of something we were talking about, not we, but on a security mailing list I'm on. And we were discussing about this whole, the deplatforming that took place in the heels of the riots last week. And it that it's hard enough to decide what happens on your own platform, but then to decide, make decisions based on what happens on sub-platforms, like sub-users and their downstream users, and the effects that your sub-users may have on the wider ecology, it comes down to demarcation points. And it's really hard in this day and age to figure out where are the demarcation points. There's an old, I think, anarchist maxim that says, your rights end where my skin starts, right? And then you have some libertarian or anarcho-capitalist people that I say, they're the ones that give us a bad name, because the phrase I always use is, you make us look like a bunch of solipsist douchebags, okay? It's sort of like, I am the only thing that exists in the universe and matters. It's like, no, it is not your God-given right to drive drunk, because you're incurring on the rights of everybody else that you're sharing the roads with. Coming back to your point, Jesse, when it goes from the book to the electronic media and then to the social media, these demarcation points become extremely blurry. Okay, so I'm running a DNS company, and then somebody sets up a website that's now talking to people who are on some app that's in their pocket, that's connecting to some other ecosystem, and some sort of mind virus is traversing along those rails, causing all kinds of whatever undesirable outcomes. How do people, so it's stewards of these various different pieces of the systems are trying to decide where the demarcation points is, where do they apply pressure, where do they let things run, and then individual people inside of these systems are saying, that doesn't matter, that's not my problem, this isn't my problem, the only problem I have right now is that I don't have what I want right now, this moment in time. And as I talk it through, it's like this realization of just how fractal and fuzzy the whole thing is, as it went from, you know, as you say, Jesse, like Gutenberg to the book to the radio to the television, and now here we are with the global internet. And pretty soon, you know, when we're walking around with wearables and IoT sensors everywhere, it's like the whole thing is going to be a mesh that blankets the entire civilization that you're living in, like a picture a smart city like Singapore or someplace. It really, I don't have an answer to it, but it really, because there's that balance there of like when you have this overriding imperative, such as like this pandemic, of like, this is what has to happen versus the individual nodes within this sort of mesh saying, what can I do about this or what is being done to me about it? I don't know if that made any sense at all, but.
Yeah, I well, there's a lot of levels in all this, as all of our salons always have multiple levels. What I think about when I'm listening to you is I'm going back to Jesse's word, which I think is really important here, is the literacy. How do all these layers of media add or detract from the general literacy? In other words, obviously YouTube University, you can learn a tremendous amount, and so that's a huge plus to our general literacy. But I suppose you could also argue that if you're going to enter a echo chamber, social media environment, then you're actually depriving yourself of literacy.
Well, and I think it's interesting, your point about the echo chambers, I'm going to push back on a little, but not as a form of devil's advocacy, in that there's a part of me that kind of appreciates echo chambers. And I don't mean echo chambers as we imagine other people having them. I mean the echo chambers that we all actually have, right? Like, if we are to be honest, everyone, for the sake of their sanity, constructs an echo chamber. And, the parallel I'm trying to draw, and Mark, you can go with this where you will, is I think there is an appropriate analogy here with Plato's cave, that the echo chamber is meant to evoke the notion of Plato's cave, that we are not seeing reality. What we perceive as reality is just the shadows that the actual action are occurring, let alone what Plato actually advocated, which is getting the F out of the cave entirely. Right. And yet what I'm suggesting, especially in a pandemic, is that there's comfort in the cave. There's comfort in watching those shadows, even if it's just entertainment, so that amidst the chaos of what's going on outside, that there is a little bit of sense of security. And so that's where I do agree that one's capacity to develop literacy is far better once you get out of the cave. But I want to call it baby steps, call it accessible actions that any individual can take. I think that we can both acknowledge that we have echo chambers and maybe configure our echo chambers a little differently. Because that's kind of what we do here on Access of Easy. Because on the one hand, we are an echo chamber, because most people are not as educated, not as self-aware, not as curious or inclined to research as the three of us are. And we are of a similar, a demographic, ethnographic background. But politically, we're all different. And we enjoy our conversations because we bring a difference in perspective and we bring a difference in ideology. And so even though we're technically an echo chamber, I think the diversity of our particular echo chamber benefits us as individuals. And so that's where I think that on the one hand, it's important to recognize the correlation between echo chambers and narcissism and the dominance of echo chambers as our contemporary media configuration. All people right now are in echo chambers. They experience the news in the world through echo chambers. And rather than disparage echo chambers, maybe we should just say, yep, we all got them, but we could do a better job of managing them. And there's ways in which we can adjust them so that they're not so toxic. Because I want to hypothesize, and I say this only in the sense that my response to the events of the last week, the last 8 days, is I've, thanks to Twitch, thanks to other media, been able to get firsthand accounts. Like, I was able to tune in to live streams of people in D.C. before, during, and after the incident. And I've been able to tune into their discussions since then. And I've been witnessing a bit of a transformation where a lot of people are like, whoa, I regret that. And like, I'm still against the state and I'm still against the status quo. But you know, in hindsight, what I did last week, oh, I wish I could not do that again. And I think that's a consequence of the echo chamber shifting. Of all of a sudden, their echo chambers having more voices, more perspective. Their politics haven't changed. They're still oppositional. They're still anti-establishment. But maybe they've seen through some of the illusions that they used to hold on to. And we all have illusions. Again, I'm not suggesting even illusions are bad. I'm just suggesting that the natural progression of human growth is that what you thought of yesterday, today, you're maybe critical of, and hopefully you'll learn something new tomorrow.
Mark, go ahead if you want.
Well, I thought you were going to say something, so I parked what I was going to say. But going back to my ears perked up when you said the Plato's cave thing, and it's a point that I've brought up. Well, I think we've all brought up a few times in the past. Is my problem now is, you know, I've just lost complete faith in the media, like the mainstream media channels. So I get all of my input, all of my news from alternative sources, and the alternative sources never went to journalism school. So it's like, you know, there was supposedly this level of
professional. Some of them did, right?
I mean, some of them did. Yeah.
Like, be honest in that alternative sources. It invokes a ludicrous level of diversity. Like, there's so much diversity there that it's hard to generalize.
Yeah. And then kind of realizing that I'm even an alternative source, like with the Access of Easy Weekly thing, to a lot of people. They say, I get my technical news from you, from this thing. And it's like, okay, I have to kind of function as a reporter, and I take that job seriously. Like, if I put something out and someone says, you got this completely wrong, I mean, I try to fix it. At least I think I do. And I'm just not seeing that. And I just feel so let down by the mainstream press that it just breaks my heart, because I remember I used to just watch this stuff, and maybe it's a good thing, I don't know, maybe it's always been this way, but I used to just watch it not uncritically, but I used to think it at least resembled reality. And I know, and the problem today is, I know it probably resembles reality, but I'm so disillusioned with it that I no longer believe it resembles reality, which makes me detached from reality, because I'm disbelieving things that are probably at least semi-true. And I'm self-aware of that. And that makes it really hard to just kind of, you know, come to an opinion about something. And maybe what that really means is I just, you know, going back to the old classical philosophers of, you can't really know anything that you don't have direct knowledge of. And maybe we do, as a society, spend way too much time opinionating about stuff we shouldn't even be talking about, because we have no idea. We have no idea what's going on in half of these things.
Yeah, well, let me jump in here. I think this is a great topic. Let me just try to make to use Jesse's word, like a hypothesis here. Because of social media and the web in general, maybe what we have is three levels that one of which didn't exist. We now have the live feeds that Jesse's referring to. So there's no mediation. We're actually seeing the live thing, where no matter what you say, the past mainstream media, it was always curated, right? In other words, there was an editor there that selected the shot of the helicopter lifting off, you know, from the embassy in Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and then there's the layer of curation, which, like Mark, you're curating to some degree, like the technical flood of information, and you're summarizing that for people, right? And then there's the level of commentary and analysis where, which I think to some degree all of us do, which is to say, hey, people, you know, of all the stuff that's flowing through here, this is what's really critical here. This is really important to understand. So let me help explain it. And so the mainstream media used to do the curation. to some degree, but mostly it was the commentary and analysis. We've chosen what's important and we're going to explain it to you. Where now you've got the live feed, you've got independent curators, and then you've got independent commentators, analysts. And so no wonder the cave has actually got like three projectors running.
Yeah. It's like the old 60s nightclubs where they had like the different, projectors running on the wall, and then the silhouettes of the dancers jumping around in front of it. And like, that's what's going on in our brains all the time now, yeah. Every day, every minute of it.
We're all on acid now, right? It's all just one level of surrealness. But I think the other aspect to this, Mark, I want to push back on your use of the word reporter, because I'm someone who doesn't believe in objectivity. Right. And I've never believed that there's such a thing as objective journalism. If they're not being transparent about their agenda, they're being dishonest, that everyone has a bias. Everyone has an agenda. Your bias might be a desire to be as neutral as possible, but that in and of itself would be a bias. Right. And so I think what you were describing was not so much a desire to be reporting, but a desire to be credible. A desire to be authentic, a desire to be honest to your audience, which I think is commendable and I think is important. I think what I see lacking in the live streaming world, what I find lacking in the social media world, is a lack of purpose, right? A lack of mission, in that there's a lot of people out there, they're not all narcissists, but many of them are, who, their only desire to use social media is to get attention. Right? That is their bias. That is their purpose. And they're not being honest about it. So they're kind of just talking about whatever gets attention. So that could be a conspiracy theory. That could be a health quackery. That could be celebrity gossip. That could be anything. Versus I personally tune into people and follow people who they've got a stated mission and purpose. Sometimes I don't always agree with that purpose, but at least it tells me that they're focused, that they're not going to waste my time, that the curation they're doing is actually going to give me knowledge and help me out. And that's another thing, if we're talking about media and we're sort of correlating it to politics, that's what I feel is lacking, both in the mainstream media and in social media. There are alternative outlets who do that. I follow them. I learn a lot from them. But I kind of feel that we're missing a culture of respecting people's attention, that it's too focused on the producer wanting attention, that they're not thinking about how do I respect my audience's attention and give them what they need as they know it, while also making sure that I don't feed them lies, while I don't feed them half-truths. And I think, Mark, that is what you're legitimately doing. Right? That you recognize that you have this audience, that it's partly customers of your business, and you don't want to waste their time. You want to give them important stuff that they need to know to make the most of their world. To me, that's not reporting. It's better, right? That's the future of media. That's synthesis, it's curation, it's authority, right? It's providing a type of signal amidst the noise. And I wish more alternative media outlets did that. Right. And I wish instead of just putting stuff out there, instead of just being a content factory, we're instead a little more had a purpose, a mission, a focus as to why they do things. And that's where I think the next wave of we're currently in the anybody has a voice, anyone can say what they want, where the mainstream media is kind of becoming increasingly irrelevant. And I think the stars, the success stories of the future are going to be the people who have that clear mission, have that clear mandate, and respect the audience's attention when it comes to giving them the content that they desire.
I think that's really well said. And it kind of clarifies my purpose, because I'm listening to you describe the necessity or the value of having a mission or a purpose, I'm thinking, yeah, maybe that's why I'm still interested in doing this stuff after I've been doing it for 15 years, is I still have a purpose and mission, like my mission and all of us to some degree. We want to clarify what we think is important and explain it and break it down so it's more digestible, we've provided a context for something that we think will help people understand what's going on. And that's a terrific mission. And I think you're absolutely right, Jesse, that that traditional corporate media has lost that ability for a variety of reasons, and it's not necessarily instilled automatically in the culture of social media.
Yeah, I think the curation function that Jesse, both of you mentioned, is an important one and one of the most abused functions today, because what'll happen, and I guess it's hard to measure the depth of what's important, what has momentum and what isn't, or what's just what will just be sensational if I amplify it, so to speak. Like, I've seen some alternative media outlets, actually even mainstream media outlets, will wrap an entire story around something that sounds outrageous and outlandish, and it's really like a tweet from somebody no one has ever heard of that's had a story scaffolded around it, and suddenly it's a phenomenon. And it's almost, and I think I even saw a reference to it in a BBC dramatization series. I can't remember the name of it. It had David Suchet played the publisher, and one of the editors said, look, you write the story, you want to have this oppositional slant to it, so just go on Twitter and find it. Somebody is saying what you want them to say. Find it, stick the tweet in there, and crap all over it. And it's like, that right there is how the media industry works today, including the alternative media. I mean, I'll even say it. I'm thinking Zero Hedge right now. Sometimes I look at it and I'm like, I've never heard of this person and what they're suggesting, and no one would care except it's on Zero Hedge right now saying, you know, look at the crazy thing this person is suggesting should happen in the world. It's like, it'll never happen because no one's ever going to hear of this person if we weren't shrieking it from the rooftops right now.
Well, and you know, let me bring this back to my favorite hobby horse topic, which is algorithms. And the way in which algorithms can be configured. Because, you know, what we're describing is the attention economy and the political economy of the way in which attention rewards people for stupid stuff. It rewards mainstream media for stupid stuff. It rewards random social media users for stupid stuff. And it creates the opportunity for a Zero Hedge. And Zero Hedge isn't alone, right? We're picking on them because we know them. But there are so many sites.
Yes, and I have a lot of respect for Zero Hedge. I will just put that in.
But my point is that the economics incentivize people to do that. And yet what I find interesting about TikTok, as flawed as it is just because it is a different algorithm than the rest of social media, it's remarkable how different the results are, how different the experience is. And it suggests that you could configure an algorithm to actually reward knowledge, to actually reward substance, to you know, favor the unknowns, favor people who haven't had a chance, to sort of democratize Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame concept. Like, there's so much you could do if the configuration of the algorithm was open to debate, or was something that people could vote on, or was something that people themselves could configure so that their user experience was different. And that's where I think we could balance out the desire to let people post whatever they want with the corruption that the algorithm fosters when it comes to rewarding people for doing stupid stuff. Because obviously Twitch is where my current scholarship or obsession, to use a synonym, is currently faced. And it's remarkable how the Twitch algorithm is different. And the Twitch algorithm rewards certain stupid people in different ways than other social media algorithms reward stupid people. And so I think in fostering that contrast, to bring it back originally to your point, Mark, that if we had a contrast in pandemic response policies, the contrast allows us to think of alternatives. The contrast makes it easier for us to imagine a different way of doing things. And I think a lot of our issues with narcissism, with the corruption of the attention economy, are actually byproducts of how the algorithm's configured. And that we could play with different ways that the algorithms are configured and actually get much different results. Again, a hypothesis, because I'm not in a position to change the algorithm. But there's a growing amount of research that says, you know, the way in which that algorithm exercises authority has direct influence and impact on the behavior of the people who are trying to game that algorithm.
Well, this brings us to something. It's almost all-encompassing concept that I guess the crypto, the Ethereum people would call layer two, where they would believe that we should have as not bare bones, but as utilitarian framework, base algorithm, like base system to run whatever application you're running on. But then people have different priorities and preferences and tolerances of different things, and none of that should be put into the algorithm, because then you're making these assumptions on behalf of other people, and all of those parameters should be set at the vaunted layer two or level two, where people can individually say, this is more important to me, reward this is less important to me, attenuate that. And I'm speaking in very generalized terms. I mean, we were talking about it in the Ethereum name service context of you know, what's going to be allowed, what's not going to be allowed in an ENS name. And the purists would say, we allow anything, but all of this abuse and network censorship and stuff, that all happens in layer two. And even if all the players involved at the higher level, every single ISP, every single name resolver, every single socket endpoint is screening out something at level two because nobody wants it, it's still has that optionality to exist, but it's just all decided at a level above it. That's kind of what you're talking about, where you're saying the algorithm should make as little decisions on behalf of people as possible. The algorithm should be functional, and then there should be this other ability for people to say, to set the priority of like, this is what's more important to me and this is less important to me. And it gets a little beyond like just having a 10 million channel universe. You know what I mean? It's a whole incentive structure.
Right. I was just thinking of the word incentive, and Jesse's word is reward, same thing. And I don't have a brilliant way to organize what you guys are talking about. I think it's really important. And what occurs to me is sort of an anecdote that I read somewhere that when you just give kids, you know, students, young students, a laptop and an internet access, and then theoretically, you know, they can look at almost anything except maybe pornography or something. The kids from lower economic, you know, social classes will tend to just end up in the sort of like low value sensationalist stuff, right? And then the kids from the higher social class will end up finding something that's maybe it's a game, but it's they're learning something useful through the game or something like that. And so there's, I guess my point is what concerns me here is I think it's totally right, is that if everything is allowed to just run to the individual, then the people who have grown up in or inhabit a deprived world, they may not even know about these other algorithms that could give them a different view of things. And so I'm not sure how we can, how can we create incentives for people to explore different algorithms than what they're used to?
Yeah, I disagree there on both counts, in the sense that I don't think incentives are necessary. I think it's a question of interface. I think that, for example, algorithmic literacy as a concept, I think is fairly widespread. I don't think it's necessarily deep, in the sense that I think most people, their algorithmic literacy is very superficial. But I think most people sort of recognize that when they go to Google, it's not a human who's giving them those results. And I think the more that they use these services, the more that they recognize certain patterns. So I think it's easy to, you know, you could have it as emoji based or emoticons, like click this button if you want more boobies. You know, click this button if you want more guns and explosion. You know, click this button if you want more cute furry animals. I really think that to have an interactive programmable algorithm requires zero literacy whatsoever, because algorithms are already interactive. Unfortunately, they're black boxes, right? The interaction is not visible to the user, but they are already trying to reverse engineer the user and anticipate what their interests are so that they can keep them on the platform even longer, right? And maximize engagement. So the notion of algorithmic transparency is to make that interaction visible to the user so that they can have some agency. And the primary argument from the platforms as to why they won't do that is because they say it'll allow people to game the system. That if they knew how the search engine worked, if they knew how the social recommendation engine worked, well, then they would just try to manipulate that, which they're already doing already. So I say at least put the rule book on the floor so that those who want to play the game know what the rules of the game are and don't get copyright strikes or don't get other penalties that they didn't realize existed. But the idea that you could create an interface that regardless of your user level, regardless of your literacy, allows you to express preference, allows you to hit the privacy button, allows you to hit the do not track button, allows you to hit the anonymity button, all that stuff could be designed easily. There's a reason why it's not, right? There's a political economy to that design as to why they make this technology so accessible, as to why they divert people with low socioeconomic status to entertainment rather than education. And so a lot of that comes down to who controls these algorithms and why. And so when I argue that we should democratize the algorithms, that we should allow individuals to have a vote, to have a voice in how these algorithms are being used, I don't think that invokes a barrier to entry. I actually think it would be pretty easy to design a democratic framework to governing algorithms that reflects the interaction that algorithms currently have. You just make it transparent, so that people could see the way in which their data is being collected and see the way in which they're engaging. And that's where, Mark, I think your blockchain analogy is spot on, right? Because that's exactly it. That in making more of the layers transparent, right, and separating them from the sort of core utility layer, it allows people to have choice, right? If I don't like your blockchain, fork it. And I can create my own blockchain where we have different values at that layer level. And that would be a different society saying, we're going to have a different economic system thanks to this software, because this software allows us to change the configuration at a much deeper level. And that's where I think the distributed ledger technology world offers a much more political nuance in the way in which a society can choose to govern itself and to choose to do the things that it does.
That might actually be a good place to call it quits for the week.
I think so too. Yeah, I think so too. Very good topic. It's because that's a whole other show to explore what you just said, Jesse, you know, democratizing the framework of and algorithms. So good stuff, you know.
Sure. Yeah, that was the Access of Easy Salon number. I actually have lost track of what number we're on, but don't forget to like us on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube. Hit that subscribe button. Tell all your friends. Visit us on accessofeasy.com, and we will see you all next time.